Here it is, the 16th of July, and the presidential election is already decided. We don't know who's going to win, but we do know whoever wins will certainly be left-handed. In fact, a large number of American presidents lean to the left, even when they did not, in politics. Commentator Frank DeFord explains that lefties do more than make great leaders. They also fill sports halls of fame.
If you're interested in having your son support you in your old age, here is my vocational advice to you. Starting when he's in the crib, turn him into a left-hander, and then train him to become a relief pitcher. There's always a well-paying place for layabout southpaw relievers, well up into their athletic dotage. You see, while lefties moan that the world at large discriminates against them, our sinister brethren have all the advantages in sports whenever they directly face right-handers. And now an engineering professor named David Peters has come up with some basic statistics which show what we righties always knew anyway, that baseball in particular is a gauche paradise, and that ain't no left-handed compliment. Whereas only about 10% of the whole human population is lefty, Professor Peters revealed that about 25% of major leaguers are the minority-handed sort of people. More significant, in the Hall of Fame, of the 70 pitchers, 15 were southpaw, more than twice the Homo sapiens average, and hitters. Of the 138 in Cooperstown, 59 were lefty and 8 more half-lefty switch hitters. That means that an incredible 46% of the best hitters ever swung at those appetizing right-handed slants. In basketball, left-handed shooters have always driven opponents crazy. The game's greatest defensive player, Bill Russell, was a southpaw, which meant that his strong arm matched perfectly for blocking right-handers' shots. In tennis, the ball spins differently off a left-hander's racket. Hello, Rafael Nadal. Roger Federer's shots that go to a fellow right-hander's weakness bounce right into Nadal's wheelhouse. Just as a statistically unusual number of baseball's greatest hitters, Cobb, Ruth, Williams, Gwynn, Bonds, were left-handed, so does Nadal come from distinguished lefty lineage. Laver, McEnroe, Connors, Navratilova. Somebody once wrote that John McEnroe would be just another losing quarterfinalist if he were right-handed. McEnroe was furious. Of course, if there'd been a fight, he surely would have battered the writer. Left-handed boxers are a scourge other fighters try to avoid. In fact, there's a theory postulated by two French sociologists at the University of Montpellier that lefties succeed so in sport because back when men faced off in man-to-man combat, lefties prevailed more often, living to pass those victorious genes on. The best proof that lefties have an advantage in man-to-man competition comes conversely from golf, where you're not playing your opponent, only that neutral little ball. In the whole history of the PGA, left-handers have only won 37 tournaments, and Phil Mickelson has personally accounted for more than half of them. Mickelson might have won even more if he didn't make so many ditzy decisions. But then, of course, as us in the smug right-handed majority are so sure of in defeat, left-handers may have the advantage in sport, but God evened that out by making them goofier.
Frank DeFord joins us each Wednesday from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut.
One of the world's cities is so large, it's reproducing itself. The city is Mumbai, with nearly 14 million people on the shores of India. It's a financial center and an entertainment capital. We'll visit there as part of the Urban Frontier, our series on the world's growing cities. Mumbai, or Bombay as it was called, is so crowded, developers have started over building new Mumbai. Here's NPR's Philip Reeves.
Caked in dust and dressed in rags, this boy is just trying to make a living. He's so small, many in the sea of people sweeping past don't notice he's there. An emaciated figure, aged about 6, begging at knee level. He works one of the world's toughest beats. It's not that people here don't have money, there are plenty of rich people around. This city's where India's money gets invested, where the business is done. Property prices rival Manhattan or London. But at knee level, on the streets, competition's as fierce as it is on the stock exchange. Half of Mumbai lives in slums, and the poor keep on arriving, hundreds every day, lured out of the countryside by the whiff of wealth. The best way to see Mumbai is by train. It's a little dangerous. Some commuter trains are so jammed, passengers just fall out. Hundreds of passengers die every year, but at least the trains move, unlike the traffic on the clogged up roads. The city's bursting at the seams. Just look out of the train window.
There are shacks with people living in them beside the railway tracks. They're washing spread out on the ground. There are blistered apartment blocks crammed full of people. A lot of trash. Open drains. You can smell them sometimes.
Mumbai was built by the Arabian Sea on a cluster of small islands that were eventually levelled to make one big island. The city can't grow sideways anymore, only upwards. Pasted on the wall of our train, there's an advertisement. It shows a metropolis lit up like Las Vegas, sprouting out of the landscape. It's called Navi Mumbai. Navi means new. That's where we're going now.
We've left Mumbai now and we're running along the coastline. To my right is the sea and some mangrove swamps. On the other side of the bay, we can now see, rising on the skyline, these high-rise modern buildings, and that's Navi Mumbai, New Mumbai. From here, it looks quite impressive.
Ashok Menon's going there too for a business appointment. He's got a good job in the shipping business and an inherited family home in Mumbai. He says he couldn't afford to buy a house in Mumbai these days.
Someone who wants to have their own property in Mumbai, either they must be very, very rich or they should probably get an inheritance. Otherwise, it's not likely that you could afford a property in Bombay anymore.
New Mumbai is considerably cheaper. We've arrived. We're sitting in what is now a cafe, but was once a mangrove swamp.
The place that we are sitting on right now was total water. So this whole area is all water. It was water. It's now become land and now it's developed.
Frank Gomez lives in Navi Mumbai.
There are malls all over, there are hotels all over. It's quite good.
Gomez is 22. That's only 6 years below the average age here. Work began on creating Navi Mumbai in 1970. The idea was to take pressure off the old city. The new city is entirely planned. For a long time, the project stagnated. But when the economy began to boom, big new companies moved in. They include India's largest private sector company, Reliance, led by the industrial magnate Mukesh Ambani. It's investing vast sums in the city. The new Mumbai has glistening shopping malls where people play indoor cricket. It also has some 2 million inhabitants, including Sushmita Sen.
Do you not live here?
Navi Mumbai? Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I just hate Mumbai.
What do you like about it?
The space, so much of space. We are a better city, we are a prettier city.
These are the young men who keep Navi Mumbai pretty. Nitin, Ranjit and Pankaj. For 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, they clean malls. They get $120 a month. 98% of the people of Navi Mumbai are literate. These three have missed out. They can't afford the boutiques and bars. For them, this place is far from utopian. Nor is it utopia for this man.
Utopia. Navi Mumbai. Good Lord. The first step to hell, if you ask me.
Environmentalist Bitu Saigal thinks Navi Mumbai is being built in the wrong place.
I would wager if you spoke to 1,000 people, perhaps one might even know that there is something called climate change, which is an issue. And Navi Mumbai is almost all created at sea level.
Saigal says Navi Mumbai is on land that belonged to indigenous village people.
There were small farmers there and there was mangroves. Mangroves and corals probably feed 25% of all humanity on Earth.
We may have hacked some mangroves, but then we have a whole new city to talk about.
That's Kishore Rathod. He's news editor at the Navi Mumbai office of the newspaper DNA. For years, he was a beat reporter here. For a long time, he thought the city would fail.
There were no trees, there was no greenery. People used to say it's a malaria-infested place. It was a nightmare.
Rathod's changed his mind. He says Navi Mumbai is adding at least 100,000 people a year.
And these people are earning good money. Now they're earning salaries upwards of 30,000 rupees, 40,000 rupees. Where do they spend that? They need the malls. They need the food courts. They need the multiplexes. They need the theatres.
Apparently, they also need fancy cars.
You have the Hummers flying on the road of Navi Mumbai. You have the Ferraris flying on the road of Navi Mumbai. Now America is going to small cars and we are talking about big cars.
On the horizon, immediately in front of me, there's New Mumbai. But on the spot where I'm actually standing, surrounded by litter, there's a line
of little shelters made out of wood and plastic sheeting. And under one of those, Arby Boyer, a fisherman, is treating his boat, made out of mango tree wood, in preparation for another night's fishing in the polluted waters that stand between these two cities, the old Mumbai and the new.
Arby Boyer is a Kohli. The Kohlis have fished these waters since way back. Boyer says he's paying the price for India's urban explosion. Some days he catches nothing because the water's so badly polluted. He's more resigned than angry.
What use is anger? No one listens to us poor people.
Getting your voice heard isn't easy. Builders are hard at work. There are plans for an international airport. This year, 5 new malls will open. Ratard, the newspaper man, expects his city to change even more in the next few years.
This place will probably be more populated, probably more congested, probably more noisy, but much more rocking.
Philip Reeves, NPR News.
Tomorrow, we visit another developing city on the urban frontier. It's Khartoum in Sudan. And an old Mumbai resident tells how she learned to love that bustling city at npr.org.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
I'm Alex Chadwick. Cancer, heart disease, diabetes, chronic illnesses are expensive. And as more than 40 million people in this country know, they're all the more devastating if you do not have health insurance.
But compare that with the situation in the Netherlands. There, people are required by law to buy insurance, and insurance companies are required to sell coverage to everyone for the same price, no matter how sick they are.
For our series on healthcare in Europe, NPR's Patty Naiman examined how the U.S. and the Netherlands handle one chronic illness, diabetes.
This story starts in the U.S. Steve Edelman lives in California. At age 15, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes.
I didn't really realize that a lot of the things to maintain my care, like a yearly eye exam, yearly kidney test, yearly cholesterol test, things like that, were not being done. It took me 10 to 15 years to finally realize what I needed to do to avoid all these terrible complications of diabetes.
Diabetics often lose feeling in their feet, which can mean broken bones and ulcers. Eye problems can lead to blindness. Patients can suffer seizures and even die. No one ever talked with Edelman about these potential complications or how to avoid them. As a result, he now suffers eye and kidney disease. Because of his experience when he was younger, Edelman became a doctor and diabetes specialist. He works at the University of California, San Diego. Dr. Edelman says the fragmented care he experienced when he was younger can be blamed on the healthcare system as a whole, but he says it's made worse by health insurance companies.
I've gone through hell and back with my insurance company getting approval for this continuous glucose monitor, which is FDA approved, and I've also had problems getting an insulin pump, which has been around now for 15 years.
Edelman has spent enormous amounts of time trying to get his insurance company to pay for the care he needs.
And I say to myself, and I've said to my wife, I'm a doctor. I know how to get around the system. I scream and yell. I say the right keywords. And I have had a hard time getting some of the things I need. I couldn't imagine how it is for a layperson who's not a physician to have to deal with this system.
Which is why Dr. Edelman created a website to help other diabetic patients. It's called Taking Control of Your Diabetes.
Patients living with a chronic disease, such as diabetes, need to know what they need to do. And that ranges from controlling their sugar levels to their blood pressure to their cholesterol to getting on an aspirin, things like that.
In the Netherlands, there's no need for patients to be so proactive. 10 years ago, the government responded to a projected diabetes epidemic by training thousands of nurses to care for these patients. Take the case of 62-year-old Renee Tyne. Tyne lives in Maastricht in the southern part of the country. Like Steve Edelman, he's struggled with diabetes for years, but unlike Edelman, Tyne isn't completely on his own.
Okay. Yeah? Bedankt.
Okay.
Tot ziens. Tot over 3 maanden.
Okay.
Every 3 months, Tyne spends about 30 minutes with a nurse specifically trained in diabetes. Marcel Brusten says this half hour is particularly valuable for Tyne.
He doesn't always think the right way for his diabetes. He thinks he's doing well, But he ends up with low blood sugar levels or too high blood sugar levels. But he can inject too much insulin, he can inject too little insulin, he can be bicycling too long or he uses too much energy. It's difficult. I think it's difficult for all the patients.
Difficult, but these routine meetings 4 times a year help keep Tyne relatively healthy. He's an avid biker who enjoys treks through the hills in nearby Belgium. But recently, Tyne did suffer a setback.
Maar het is in 2004 dat ontstaan, tijdens vakantie.
It all started when I was on vacation in 2004. While I was on holiday, I had to go see the doctor every day. My toe was getting bigger and redder.
Once Tyne got home, his general practitioner sent him to the Diabetes Center at University Hospital in Maastricht. He was diagnosed with a rare problem that occurs in patients who no longer have feeling in their feet. The nerves don't function properly, the bones weaken and crumble, causing sores and infection, and can sometimes even lead to amputation. But when those symptoms began for Tyne, he got comprehensive care. His diabetes specialist, Dr. Nicholas Schopper.
He was immediately referred to our multidisciplinary outpatient clinic for diabetic foot patient problems. And there is a team of an orthopedic surgeon, an internist, a rehabilitation doctor, and a shoemaker, and a plaster technician who immediately could start therapy with intensive treatment with plaster techniques.
Tyne wore a plaster cast for about 4 months. Today, his foot is pretty much back to normal. A success, Schopper credits, not to luck, but to a system that's geared to kick into action when problems occur. Compare that to the U.S., where it's fair to say insurance companies try to avoid patients like Renee Tyne and patients like 43-year-old Neil McGill, who lives in Chicago. McGill is overwhelmed with medical bills.
Oh, I have one from the hospital which is $43,000. I have one that's $11,000. I have some that's $4,000, $5,000, $2,000, $5.67.
McGill's insurance covered only $1,500 of the hospital costs. He's a part-time employee, so he had partial benefits. McGill works in a warehouse lifting and moving heavy boxes. And like Renee Tyne, he doesn't have any feeling in the bottom of his feet.
I came home Saturday morning and discovered that I had blood on my sock and a bottle cap was inside my shoe.
McGill's wound was treated, but it became infected anyway.
My blood was infected through my whole body, which caused my foot to swell and it was pain and everything else.
Doctors tried to avoid it, but McGill's toe had to be amputated, and with it, a lot of natural padding on the bottom of his foot was also removed.
So, Mr. McGill, I'm about to go and inject you. I'm going to use a little bigger needle than I normally use because we're going to go and...
At Chicago's Rosalind Franklin University Hospital, McGill's doctor, Stephanie Wu, injects his foot with silicone to help build up the padding and reduce the pressure on his foot. But McGill's still in pain. Surgery would help, but he can't afford it. A $675 custom-made shoe could stabilize his foot, but he can't afford that either. After McGill maxed out on his hospital bills, his insurer dropped his coverage. For now, he pays his doctor what he can, when he can. Dr. Wu.
I do whatever I can. I go beg and plead for him. And it's very frustrating because I feel like I spend more time writing letters to insurance companies than treating patients.
I think that's a ridiculous system. And I think it's a very costly system.
Dutch endocrinologist Nicholas Schopper.
Your system, if I may say so as a foreigner, is extremely insufficient and extremely overspending on a minority of patients and underspending on a majority of patients.
The U.S. spends more than double what the Dutch spend on health care per person. But in the Netherlands, everyone has health insurance and access to medical care. The Dutch government even pays insurance companies a subsidy to make sure they cover high-cost patients like Renee Tyne. Wijnand van de Ven is a health economist.
It means that for an 80-year-old person, on average, the insurer will receive the tenfold payment that they receive for the young ones. And within each age group, they receive a much higher payment for the chronically ill, the diabetic patients, the cancer patients, the AIDS patients.
So instead of running away from high-cost patients with chronic problems, Dutch insurance companies end up competing for their business. Patty Namond, NPR News.
We've got more on how the Netherlands' healthcare system compares to other European countries and to America at npr.org/yourhealth. Back now with Day to Day. The next Batman film, The Dark Knight, opens tomorrow at midnight. But the most fascinating character in this version is the villain, the Joker, played by actor Heath Ledger, who died shortly after filming was completed. He had said this role was more fun than anything he'd ever done.
It was one of those moments where I was asked if I would be interested in playing the Joker, and I knew 5 seconds later exactly how to play it.
As part of the NPR series In Character, Day to Day's Alex Cohen reports the Joker has had many interpretations.
The Joker, that clown prince of crime, that harlequin of hate, first appeared 68 years ago in the comic book titled Batman Number One. Though he's now famous as Batman's chief nemesis, the Joker didn't start out that way. In 1940, he was just a bit role. His creators at DC Comics initially got rid of the Joker after just his second appearance.
They killed him.
Comic book writer Steve Englehart.
And it was an editor at DC Comics who said, wait a minute, this guy's pretty good. So they added a panel at the end of the story where in the ambulance the doctor goes, well, I'm amazed this guy is actually going to live. And then he started appearing quite often after that.
Over the years, there have been various interpretations of the Joker's origins. Most stories involve an ordinary crook who fell into a vat of chemicals while running away from Batman. When the criminal emerged, his hair was bright green, his face ghostly white, his lips fiercely red and frozen in a clownish grin. Steve Englehart says that look was originally inspired by a 1928 silent movie called The Man Who Laughs.
The makeup is precisely what you think of as the Joker. So they just stole it cold. I think in the 40s in comic books, nobody much worried about things like that.
Back then, the Joker was a pretty straightforward psychopath. He stole things, he killed people, but, says Englehart, his real goal was something much bigger than committing crimes.
His main motivation is really to play with the Batman. He sees the Batman as his perfect other. And the Joker doesn't want to kill the Batman because then he wouldn't have a Batman to play with.
In the 1950s, the character went through a metamorphosis when a group called the Comics Code Authority was created in response to what some deemed as inappropriate material. When censors banned excessive violence from comic books, the Joker became much less dark and a lot more silly, kind of a thieving trickster. That goofier version of the villain jumped out of comic books and onto TV in 1966 when ABC launched its version of Batman. Cesar Romero's Joker sported a technicolor purple suit and looked like a villainous Liberace. Romero laughed more than he ever spoke, and when he did talk, he was feverishly fond of alliteration. During the 1960s, the Joker was mostly absent from the Batman comic books, but he had a big comeback in the 70s with several writers, including Steve Englehart. Englehart says he had no interest in the family-friendly, goofy Joker. He wanted the character to go back to his original roots.
He was this very crazy, scary character. I really wanted to get back to the idea of Batman fighting insane murderers at 3 a.m. under a full moon as the clouds scudded by.
Englehart's much darker interpretation of the Joker later became part of the inspiration for Jack Nicholson's portrayal of the role in Tim Burton's 1989 film Batman.
Can somebody tell me what kind of a world we live in where a man dressed up as a bat gets all of my press? This town needs an enema.
In a promotional video for the film, Nicholson said he's often told in real life that he oversteps the boundaries of good humor, but Nicholson added he doesn't have anything on the Joker.
Things that even the wildest comics might be afraid to find funny, burning somebody's face into oblivion. destroying a masterpiece in a museum, not this character. And I love that.
Humor has always been a pivotal part of the Joker, and though we usually think of humor as an enjoyable, likable trait, it can also be tinged with evil, says Paul Levitz, president and publisher of DC Comics.
There's a level in humor where humor can verge on being offensive or invasive of your space or your life, where you don't quite know what's going on. Is this guy putting me on? Is he actually going to do those things to me?
In the 1988 DC comic book called The Killing Joke, the man who eventually becomes Batman's archenemy starts off as a chemical engineer who quits his job to become a stand-up comedian. He fails miserably.
Yeah, I could see somebody getting really crazy off of that.
Maz Jobrani is a real-life stand-up comic, a funny one, but even he has rough nights. Jobrani says he easily sees how a failed comedian like the Joker could become bitter after bombing on stage.
A lot of times comics will then get upset at the audience for not understanding them, and they go, "You don't understand me. I'm funny. You people are horrible. You people should go to hell."
Jobrani adds that many comics, like the Joker, are a little bit crazy. They're funny because they see the world in a different way than most sane people do. In his interpretation of the Joker in the new film, The Dark Knight, actor Heath Ledger thrives on that insanity.
You know, you remind me of my father. I hated my father.
I keep coming back to the way he physically incarnates madness.
DC Comics president Paul Levitz.
Leave the makeup aside, leave the costuming aside. If you had Heath Ledger in plain clothes, who's very handsome, well-presented, very affable-looking man, if he walked in a room and started acting with the behaviors that he uses for the Joker, you'd get the hell out of that room fast. And that's pretty cool.
Ledger's Joker may be enthralling for viewers, but playing the role definitely took its toll. The Australian actor told reporters that he barely slept while playing the part. He said even when his body was exhausted, he couldn't stop his mind from reeling. The challenge of the role wasn't lost on Jack Nicholson. When told of Heath Ledger's death, the actor's immediate response was, "I warned him." Alex Cohen, NPR News.
Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The piece is by Mozart. The recording in our studio is by Lang Lang. The Chinese-born pianist came to the U.S. when he was 14 to study at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. He's now 26. Lang Lang has now written an autobiography, Journey of a Thousand Miles. He writes about how moving to the U.S. meant abandoning what he says was a typically Chinese approach to his career, trying to be number one.
Piano Bravo. Is a little bit squeaky.
The piano is squeaky. Well, you describe this great transition in your life as a pianist when you come to America and the pianist Gary Graffman is your teacher.
Absolutely.
You and your father, who was with you, just assumed what you should be doing is entering piano competitions one after another. That's what you do.
I would thought that because I won some international competition when I was very young. So I came to America when I was 14 years old to Mr. Graffman, and he said, in the first lesson, I like to be like Tiger Woods, winning all the big competitions.
You want to win the Masters.
Yeah,
of piano,
I want, yeah. You know, the Tchaikovsky, Chopin, Von Kleinberg, Liszt, Queen Elizabeth, I want to win five. And he was laughing at me. He said, "It's a nice dream, but you don't really need it." He said, "You want a long career or you want a short fame?" And I said, "Of course, long career." Mm-hmm. And he said, "So then you just study. Then work very hard on your piano playing, but don't think about others. And then one day somebody will probably not able to play in one concert. And if you succeed as a replacement, then you have a career."
Yeah.
And I didn't believe him in that moment. You know, I was thinking, oh my God, America should be like China because America is also very competitive. So,
yeah, I remember what you write about is you said, what do you mean people don't want to be number one here?
Right.
Michael Jordan wants to be number one here playing basketball.
Yeah. But now I think he's totally right, of course. Yeah.
How would you describe performing and the reaction of an audience here and in China? Who's at the concert and how do they react to you?
In America, a good advantage is that the American audience are much more professional and much more knowledgeable about classical music than the Chinese audience. The other side is that they are so professional, but they're also pretty old.
Yes.
So
you look at an audience in the United States.
Yeah,
and you're
looking
at a lot of people
60,
who are 60 years old. And older.
Yeah, it's nothing wrong with over 60, but
I hope
but,
not.
You know, we also need young people. The thing is, if you go to a concert hall, if 80% or 90% or 100% audience are over 60,
right,
you know, there is a problem.
It's a problem if you're planning on a long career because those people aren't going to be around.
Maybe they will till 120 years old. But anyway, and in China it's the opposite. The good advantage is Chinese audience are very, very young, younger than me. The bad side is they don't really know classical music, but they like to listen. For the education, it's similar. There are 35 million kids learning piano in China.
35 million kids are taking piano lessons.
Yes, but not enough good teachers. And here in America, I think we have more good teachers, but sometimes student doesn't work so much.
so you're moving from China to here is a logical...
Yeah, it's kind of really logical because China still don't have... the education system is better. I would say, you know, it's much better, but... It's still no match to Curtis or Juilliard, you know, of the top American schools, no match.
I'd like you to play us something that you've been working on, something you'd like to play for us. I mean, I realize that's hard.
I mean, not hard. I mean, I'm working on Goldberg variation.
On Bach's Goldberg variations.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can do whatever. So
now there's a piece which was famously recorded by the great Canadian pianist Glenn Gould, so much so that his critics said this is more Gould than it is Bach. I mean, he's interpreted it so much that he's put his...
I really have an argument with this. First of all, I'm a super fan of Glenn Gould. I love his music. I think he's a genius. Mm-hmm. My argument is very clear. Does anyone knows what Bach played on Goldberg variation? That's the first question. Mm-hmm. Second is, as a pianist, we all look at the scores. And Goldberg variation, he didn't write so much. You know, the articulation is empty there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can put all your imagination. So that's why made Glenn Gould so special for Goldberg variation is because Bach gave him unlimited element to make things happening in this work. Unlike, you know, sometimes Beethoven probably will write something, and then you can say he played more Glenn Gould than Beethoven. Mm-hmm. That I can imagine. I can think about it.
Right.
But for Goldberg variation, I really don't see this happens.
So do you approach it by thinking, what is Lang Lang's Goldberg variations going to sound like? Is it a personal creative project for you?
Reason is that because I admire both Glenn Gould's recording so much. And so that's why I'm thinking, you know, I probably should also learn it. What I like to do is to recreate something that it's something quite unique, the sound in Bach, because this is one of the very few Bach pieces that you can create some kind of sound effects. And I think this is certainly, we can do it in many of the passages like such as... And also the freedom of singing. You know, I worked with Hanenkor on this, the great Austrian, on this variation.
Yes.
Because this guy is kind of an expert on the harpsichord. And he told me that this piece this passage, you actually can do many, many written neutro and then, you know, rubatos, but and then to feed it back or something. So he showed me many places. And this opens my eye on how to play Goldberg variation.
Lang Lang, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
Lang Lang's book is Journey of a Thousand Miles. Since he says his book is about fulfilling one's dreams, he played Schumann's Traumerei, or Dreaming, for us. You can hear and see Lang Lang play Beethoven in our studios. You can read an excerpt from his new book and watch a Lang Lang slideshow, all at the music section of our website, npr.org. There is another young pianist, actually very young, who is Chinese-American and who absolutely idolizes Lang Lang. We'll hear from him tomorrow.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Let's drill down now through some election polling numbers. In a couple of swing states, Ohio and Florida, most voters, in fact 7 out of 10 voters, say the economy is one of the things that will matter most in November. We want to understand what economic issues are having the greatest impact on voters, so NPR teamed up with the Kaiser Family Foundation and Harvard School of Public Health. They all conducted a poll in 2 states. NPR's Greg Allen reports that in Florida, half of those polled say they are struggling with multiple economic problems.
There's the collapse of the housing market and the decline in home values. Also a credit crunch, making it hard for consumers to borrow their way out of trouble. And then the triple or quadruple whammy, spiraling fuel and food prices. In the new poll, more than 3/4 of people in Florida said they were facing at least one serious economic problem. Half said they were struggling with 3 or more. The big ones? It's jobs, gas prices, housing, and health care. Molly Ann Brody with the Kaiser Family Foundation says it's not just people with low and middle incomes who are affected.
The higher income level folks are still reporting challenges. Their challenges are just different. Their challenges are with declining home values, with being able to buy or sell their house, with their gas, with losing money in the stock market. So I think one of the things that is different about this particular situation is that you are seeing people across the income spectrum suffering.
The poll found broad similarity in how Ohioans and Floridians rate their economic problems. Both say their inability to get a good job or a raise in pay is a top concern. But in Florida, the collapse in home values ranks higher as an economic problem than in Ohio. And for people in the real estate, banking, and construction industries, it's also a jobs issue. Tom Heinrich is a 65-year-old mortgage broker from Pompano Beach. Most of his business is in the 2 states hit hardest by the housing bust, California and Florida.
It's destroyed what I had just a few short years ago. I personally have seen a dramatic, dramatic decline in income and opportunity, and I don't see it recovering quickly or anytime in the near future.
But in Florida, Ohio, and nationally, the clear number one problem for Americans now is gas prices.
We absolutely think twice about driving. We think 3 times about driving.
Dee Moscona is a 47-year-old attorney and mother in Miami. Like 55% of people polled in Florida, she cited rising gas prices as her top economic challenge.
I decided not to send my kids to camp this summer because I couldn't afford it. So we decided a bunch of moms to get together and do like a mommy camp where no mom wanted to drive.
The other major economic concern in Florida? The cost of health care. In the poll conducted by NPR, the Kaiser Family Foundation, and Harvard School of Public Health, more than 1/4 of Floridians say they're having trouble paying medical bills. More than half say they've delayed getting needed care because of the cost. And 65-year-old Alvis May from Miami says just because you're covered by Medicare, that doesn't mean you can find affordable health care.
Well, we find that Medicare has not been rewarding the physicians enough that many times it's difficult to find a doctor who will take Medicare. So even though you think you're insured, you can't find a doctor to provide the treatment, you might as well not have Medicare.
More than 4 in 10 Floridians polled believe that expanding health coverage to all Americans would do a great deal to help fix the country's economic problems. A similar number say the same thing about reducing health care costs. But according to the poll, the top 2 things people in Florida say would help the most, stop American jobs from going overseas, and pull U.S. troops out of Iraq. For Miami attorney and mom Dee Moscona, Iraq is an economic issue.
Absolutely. Iraq is draining everything. It's a demoralizing, horrible thing that we're stuck with, that we have to live with.
Overall, the NPR, Kaiser, Harvard poll confirms with numbers what most of us already knew. The economy is bad, Americans are hurting, and they're looking to their political leaders for help. But amid all the negatives, Molly Ann Brody of the Kaiser Family Foundation says the poll shows that on one point, people in Florida are optimistic.
Majorities in Florida across all income groups believe that the president can do a lot or a little to improve the economy. So there is certainly an expectation that is set up out there that says that a president can actually address this.
Because of the depth of concern, politically speaking, it may not matter that in reality the president has little direct control over the economy. Over the next 3.5 months, people in Florida and across the nation can expect to hear much more from the presidential candidates about the economic problems they face and what they'll do to fix them. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
Okay, that's Florida. Later today on All Things Considered, we're going to hear how jobs are the concern for many families in Ohio. For more on how residents of these two key states are feeling the economic pinch and full results of the poll, just go to npr.org/NPR poll.